It was one of those days that I decided to go down a rabbit hole. I just did a search for haunted. Spooklight came up, the Joplin Spooklight, and then I found a book and went to Dark Ozarks. So my guest is going to tell us all about Dark Ozarks. You can check it out. YouTube has videos. They also have a podcast. Lisa Martin and Josh Heston. They investigate, explore, cover mysteries, legends, folklore, and hauntings of the Ozarks. Up close and personal. An example.
We were starting to leave. It's probably 1 a.m. You have to walk out quite a ways to the parking area. And I happen to be the last person in line. And we're walking, and all of a sudden, I start to take a step, and boom, I can't take a step. And I had the wet blanket effect, and I've had other investigators describe it as well. It's the only thing I can describe it as is as if the heaviest, wettest blanket fell over you, what that would feel like. But there's nothing there physically, and you can still see everything.
Lisa Martin is my guest with Dark Ozarks, and that's Missouri for anyone who's listening who is not from the United States. This is like the heartland, the center of the United States, Missouri, Kansas. We'd like to brag about that.
Yes, we do.
Just because. But Lisa is also a paranormal investigator, and I saw a show on KOAM, a feature about the Spooklight, which is near Joplin. And that's a fascinating area, but you do all sorts of paranormal. So just a quick recap, who you are and how this got started for you, for Dark Ozarks.
My day job is I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law in Missouri for more years than I want to put out to the world. And I ended up getting into paranormal investigation, research, writing books, and then ultimately Dark Ozarks, going down a rabbit hole that, you know, I never foresaw. And if you had told me 25 years ago I'd be doing these things, I would have told you you were crazy. Long story short, I did grow up in a farmhouse that had activity. So from a very young age, I knew odd things happened in places. But I grew up, went off to school, started my career, started a family, etc. And paranormal was the last thing on my mind. And a number of years ago, I was looking at a house to buy. It was a turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, arts and craft home, very pretty. And my husband at the time was with me. We had been upstairs, and I come downstairs with the agent, and there were four flights of switchback stairs from the second floor down to the living room. And he had lingered. He starts to come down, and he'd take a step or two and stop, a step or two and stop. And I'm talking to the woman about numbers, et cetera, and I started kind of looking over him like, what are you doing? And he finally gets to the bottom and goes, did you guys hear that? And, you know, we're like, no. Then we're in the basement after that. And there was a large central room. The old boiler was still sitting there. And I kind of lingered. They'd walked over to a side room. And suddenly I had the distinct and very cold feeling, almost dry ice kind of cold feeling, of a thumb being laid across one side of my neck. And then one, two, three, four fingers on the other side. So like a hand gripping my throat. And then the sensation went through the back of my neck. And I thought, I'm not really sure that I want to do my laundry down here.
Yeah.
A little up close and personal. So I walked over to the room that they had walked into in time to hear the agent say, now, I don't know what this room would have been used for. And I looked at it, and on one wall, it was all old apothecary cabinets, entire wall. Far wall had seven very large metal sinks. And the floor, the concrete floor, had the largest drain in a residence I've ever seen.
Okay.
And I just looked at her and said, I'll tell you what it is. It was the embalming room, and I turned and started towards the stairs. And I can still hear her stiletto heels chasing me, you know, after me going, well, I guess I should tell you this was a mortuary in the 1920s. And I said, yeah, I figured that one out.
Oh.
Ironically, I ended up purchasing a house a block and a half away. So over time, I walked the neighborhood and I noticed over time, instinctually, I would walk to the other side of the street to walk past that house. I'm not typically shy about anything, and certainly in paranormal or anything else, but it was just something I just noticed over time. And I noticed other people walking in the neighborhood would do the same thing. And it, you always had the sense that you were being watched. Then I noticed that, you know, no one stayed in the house very long, over a year or two. And ironically, then years later, after I'm in the field, during a public event, we had taken a pause, and I hear this couple talking about a house, and they said enough, I thought, that's that house. So I asked them, and it was. And someone in their family had owned it back in the 80s, and I guess all kinds of things happened to the point that they literally kind of threw things in the car and left in the middle of the night. But it was that experience that got me thinking, okay, I really want to know why these things happen. And that's when I started getting into researching, investigating, ultimately writing books, etc. So fast forward, 2016, I'm in the middle of a cemetery in Joplin, Missouri. It's the oldest cemetery in the area and reputed to be haunted too. And it's October, and I'm being interviewed by a TV crew about upcoming events and history, etc. And ironically, my partner, Josh, pulls into the cemetery doing research on a story, and he lives 2 hours away. And he pulls in while this is going on and kind of hangs out, and we ended up meeting afterwards. So literally, we met in a haunted cemetery.
I like that part. The ambiance really sells it. Okay. And that's after you get to the dead bodies of the house that you almost bought. And I mean, that, when you're saying the walls were lined with the apothecary little storage units, and large, extra large sinks, and a huge drain in a place that's called a home. I'm like, oh yeah, this is like morgue.
Yeah, it definitely, yeah. It was a mortuary. And ironically, now I actually, over time, later became friends with the family that owned the funeral home, that they still have the business, but was in that house years and years ago, ironically. So, you know, everything seems to come full circle with all with this. But that's where it all got started. So Josh and I got to know each other, and over time we started collaborating on different projects, and ultimately, Dark Ozarks kind of organically grew out of it. Initially, it was pitched as a TV show, and we were pretty well green lit, and then COVID hit. And so subsequently, there's been sales between networks, et cetera, that, you know, everything's on hold on that. But in between, our showrunner said, you'll create content. So we started the podcast.
Absolutely. Because there's so much history in Missouri. I mean, there's no end to what you can do with this in terms of, you know, the Civil War aspect, the ghosts, the areas that would have elementals, the Ozarks itself by Branson and all that. I mean, there's just so much going on there that, I see a lot of potential.
And then, well, of course, and the Ozarks actually covers ground in actually 5 states. And so most of it in Missouri, then a good portion in Arkansas, but also in eastern Oklahoma, a sliver of southeast Kansas, and a sliver of southern Illinois. So it's kind of funny. When we started, it was like, I wonder how many episodes we can get out of this. And we are now going on 4 years and realize we've barely scratched the surface.
Okay, so in all that time, since I've been to Mena, Arkansas, and a few other places I know, that eastern Oklahoma, have you done anything on Bigfoot? I didn't see that in your archives just yet.
Actually, we have. we have a couple of times, and there are several distinct Bigfoot profiles, I guess you would say, mm-hmm. in the Ozarks. Eastern Oklahoma is a big area and a lot of activity. And I have a friend who, he's also an attorney, who has land in the mountains, who's had experiences. But I've also run into people who've had sightings of Bigfoot in urban areas in Oklahoma. And ironically, and this made so much sense to me, basically having experiences when they were traveling along railroad tracks. And I got to thinking, that made so much sense to me, because if you are a large primate and you are trying to avoid people, but needing to travel through a more populated area, railroad tracks make perfect sense, because one, we don't have passenger trains pretty much on most lines anymore. And two, people generally are not out there walking. So except for an occasional freight train that they could avoid, it's a pretty good conduit.
Yeah.
But there are Bigfoot stories in the Ozarks that go back hundreds of years. Earliest accounts really come from about the 1830s and are referred to as the Arkansas Wild Man. And originally, the stories were depicted and told as feral people stories coming out of the New Madrid earthquakes from 1811-1812, which were the strongest earthquakes recorded in North America. In fact, at one point caused the Mississippi to run backwards and actually caused a lot of land to move states, because it shifted the channel of the Mississippi. So it was assumed these people, basically in the tremors afterwards, there were over 20,000 tremors in about 9 months, that people basically went kind of bonkers and ran off into the woods. And so for about 20 or 30 years, you get a lot of these tales that people are telling, but they are assuming they're just feral people. And then it changes over time to describing them as Bigfoot or Sasquatch creatures. Then, of course, you have in southern Arkansas, you have the folk monster, a la Legend of Boggy Creek, which is more a creature that is more of a swamp ape kind of creature. Another one that gets a lot of press these days is Momo, the short for Missouri Monster,
yeah.
up in Louisiana, Missouri. Ironically, that's the one with the least traction, because there is one seminal event where it was seen in the 1970s by a 16-year-old girl and her younger brothers. She's babysitting them, and they're out playing in the yard. She's doing dishes, and something comes up in the tree line at the edge of the yard, and they see this. And then there's a handful of sightings later after it's been reported in the press. But really, you don't get too much, you know, recurring sightings from it. But you do have in south central Missouri and extreme north central Arkansas, you have a creature that has been repeatedly reported since the 1860s, called the Blue Man. And it is a Bigfoot type creature that you would think of, you know, pretty much from the Pacific Northwest in description, with black fur that has a blue hint to it in the sunlight. And there are actually two legends as to why it's called the Blue Man. That's one. The other is one of the first men to report seeing it was on a logging crew. And early on, it was all logging crews that encountered this thing. And his nickname was Blue. And so some people said it got that name because he told the story first, but not really sure on that. But the Blue Man probably is the more credible cryptid story out of the Ozarks.
Mm-hmm. Because of the loggers.
Well, because of that and repeated sightings over time. Now the folk monster down at Boggy Creek, it is as well. It's had repeated sightings over 100 years. So mm-hmm. that sounds very credible, but from descriptions, I think it's more of a swamp ape versus your more mainstream thought of as Bigfoot creature that the blue man seems to be. So I think you really kind of have two different creatures going on there.
Okay, I want to go back real quick. That hand that you felt in the house, in the basement, were you mm-hmm. able to reconcile that one?
I couldn't reconcile it with any, you know, natural cause or something. I mean, it certainly was not, you know, the ventilation draft or something, you know.
No.
To me, it was very purposeful. It was interactive. Like I said, it was cold, almost dry ice cold. And I've been touched several times over the years investigating. That is probably... That and one other instance are the ones that stand out the most as far as being the most distinct. I mean, it was very distinct sensation of, you know, a thumb and 1, 2, 3, 4 fingers and done very purposely. It was, my sense was I'm in control or I'm going to intimidate. Who it is, I have no idea. But from the couple that I, you know, years later talked to, their family members who had lived there encountered something that, as they said, ended up chasing one of the kids down the hallway, et cetera, and had them so afraid that they ended up literally throwing some clothes in the car and leaving and then hiring movers to move their stuff out later.
Yeah, that's pretty intense.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, why there, I don't know. I've encountered a number of haunted funeral homes over the years, which in a way kind of surprises me because actually, as I said earlier that Josh and I met at a haunted cemetery, my experience is that most cemeteries are not haunted. That one happens to be haunted more for other events around it over time, including mass unmarked graves from the Civil War.
Yeah.
And so I don't think most people end up hanging out at their tombstone.
There's usually a reason. There's some kind of trauma or some kind of, you know, an intense emotional event that brings on something that residual, a haunting.
Not necessarily. Actually, a lot of times it's because it's something pleasant, you know, an attachment to a home or a place that they just had good memories with or whatever. So it could be tragic. It could be something very positive. But usually, you know, there's not much emotion one way or the other with a cemetery.
Well, that's what I was meaning with a cemetery, right, when there's that kind of intense.
Right.
It's more of a negative than a positive.
Right. Yeah. Usually something else has happened there that has caused that. Yeah. And that's true. I agree with you there. And with funeral homes, you know, I'm kind of on the fence as to why there do seem to be a lot that are haunted, but the real reason I'm not sure, because typically, you know, they pass before they get there, just like pass before you get to the cemetery. So I'm not really sure, but then a lot of funeral homes are in former homes, and so could have been lived in beforehand, so there you could have activity there that predates it being a funeral home, too. So,
have you been to Weston, Missouri?
I have not been to Weston.
I was just thinking that was another cemetery with a ton of unmarked graves, Civil War period, and that they have a huge number of unmarked graves for, at this point, you know, Civil War, they didn't have a cemetery mm-hmm. devoted to black, and they had a split, so it was segregated, and a lot of those graves that were designated for black people were put into this unmarked area that they just, that's where they all went, and so there's still, mm-hmm. you know, that history is there, and Weston has a lot of other history, too. I was just curious. I'm sure, I mean, since you guys are into this, I'm sure that'll eventually make it on your list.
Oh, I've read about Weston, and it is on our bucket list. Our problem is our bucket list keeps growing and growing and growing.
That's good. That's excellent. That's excellent. Okay, now you also have, it's getting beyond the Sasquatch, the Native Americans have stories with Sasquatch too. So it isn't just, one of the colonial aspects of running into this thing. The Native Americans have predate the colonists. And so their stories, I think, also merit some credit because there weren't railroads to divert their attention. This is something that they were living in, basically in conjunction together, sharing the same territory. And their stories, I think, have a lot of merit too with the Bigfoot Sasquatch.
Oh, I agree. I definitely agree. And they have, and there are accounts of other types of creatures as well. Even in the Ozarks, there are accounts of, skinwalkers or skinwalker type creatures that, although we associate them with the Southwest and the Comanche predominantly, but other tribes had similar lore. The Quapaw tribe, they originally were from the Southeast and relocated into Northeast Oklahoma. They have tales of creatures or spirits, or actually both, one and the same, that they call the Iwa. And they describe them as they're physical, but they are spirit as well, so that they can appear to be as physical and dense as a living person, but yet they are a spirit, but they are not ancestor spirit. And they tend to be mischievous and tricksters. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of different lore from the Native Americans. And through this area, you get a lot of lore about the little people as well.
Yes, yes. Okay, go there. Go there.
Well, a number of tribes across the U.S. Have lore about the little people, but the Cherokee do predominantly in this area, as well as the Quapaw and others. The little people are akin to Irish fairies, and Irish fairies are not the Disney type fairies that we see on TV or movies. Irish fairies are much more akin to Washington Irving type stories of, what lures you into the forest and makes you sleep for 100 years. They are known to draw people away from their homes, and they basically get lost in time, forget time, and then maybe show up 100 years later or whatever. There are even tales of them stealing children. There is a bit of a djinn quality to them in that they can grant wishes. But it's one of those things you have to be very careful, because, be careful of what you ask for, because you may get it.
Well, there might be something. If you ask for something, then you're supposed to give something in return.
Well, yes, you have to make it. Well, in most of the lore for the little people, you have to make an offering before they will appear. Mm-hmm. An offering of a food, particularly sweets. And they will appear, and you can ask them for a wish, but it is advised not to do so. There's a pretty well-known story about John Ross, one of the early chiefs of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, that he and some friends had ridden out fox hunting one morning. And they rode over a hill and actually came across a group of little people. And they describe little people as being about 2 feet tall, with hair down to the ground. But otherwise, they pretty much look like Native Americans. And part of the lore is, if you see them or you encounter them, you're not supposed to talk about it. And so they come over the hill, come across this group of little people, and literally, pull up the horses, and, he waves to everyone, and they ride back and get back to the house. And he says, no one's to speak of this. Of course, obviously someone did, because we know the story.
Yeah.
But it's that cautionary tale. You do not speak of the little people if you have encounters with them, because even then they have power over you.
Well, it's like the hitchhiker effect of once you start bringing something into the manifest plane, then you're giving it permission and you're giving more weight to it so it can follow you.
Yes. I mean, that's true. That's true. And so you have a lot of that lore in this area as well.
The other thing, too, that Missouri also has had UFO stories.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Actually, by some accounts, the first Seminole UFO, quote, crash happened in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and not Roswell, if the story is believed, in 1941. It's one of those stories that it may be credible, but again, as with most of these, you can't really prove it. But the story goes that there was a crash near the Army airfield at Cape Girardeau, and it's at night, and so they call out a local minister to perform last rites. And so, you know, he's just thinking, oh, it's a plane crash, you know. And so he rides out there with the police chief, and when he gets there, his description is, this isn't an airplane. It's another, you know, it's something else that has crashed, and that there are entities in it that are not human, and that he, you know, actually prayed over one as it was dying, and that they were there before actually the Army got there. And then the Army showed up, took possession of the bodies and the debris, and then told everyone, don't talk about this. This actually was a little before we got involved in the war. So you didn't have the speculation of, is there something going on because of the war effort? And apparently there was supposed to have been a photographer, a newspaper photographer there who took a photo, but then over time, supposedly the photo has been lost. So, but the sheriff ended up conveying his observations to, I think it was a brother, and it was done and recorded and actually notarized. And then the minister in his later years confided in a grandchild of what he saw.
See, that's kind of similar to Roswell in terms of getting mm-hmm. rid of some of the evidence that accidentally disappears and can't be found anymore. Uh-huh. But then the children of the survivors, the experiencers, grandchildren specifically mm-hmm. from Roswell, talk about what their relatives said and what they were not supposed to say. And all of, you know, all of that folklore that comes along with that, it gives you a sense that there's more going on because of the immediate rush to hush the storytellers at the very beginning. And so then it trickles right. out later.
Right. Because, and they abide by that because they feel like they're doing their patriotic duty. And none of these people tried to make a profit on it either, which is, it makes it more credible, I think, too. But then if you fast forward to 1973, you have the Piedmont incident near Piedmont, Missouri, which actually is not very far from Cape Girardeau. Basically the same area, and you had a number of encounters and sightings over roughly a 10 or 11 month period, and hundreds of witnesses, and witnesses that were very credible in the community. You had high school teachers, you had law enforcement involved, you had different professionals as witnesses. And it was also the first time that there was actually a serious study done by an academic as things were happening. A professor at the local university, Dr. Rutledge, he was a physics professor, actually conducted a study and talked to hundreds of these witnesses and gathered what information he could, and ultimately it was published in a book. But it's the first serious study of what was going on, and his conclusion was that it wasn't anything man-made that the public was aware of. But it started out actually with a basketball team, high school basketball team. They were driving back from a game, and in a van, and they started seeing a light, and it was basically tracking them and so forth. And then it disappeared. And then a few miles down the road, it appears again. And so it was actually the high school coaches who first reported it to the police. And then there were other witnesses that night that were, and this goes on almost a nightly basis for months. It's never really been solved. But an interesting thing is that if you watch the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and the scene at the beginning where they see the lights, that is based on the accounts from Piedmont.
Lisa Martin with Dark Ozarks. A quick break. Lisa Martin, she hosts Dark Ozarks with Josh Heston.
Well, there's another person who considers himself an abductee, an encounter person, who's also got a legal background. As a matter of fact, he was a lawyer and a former assistant attorney general. I don't know if you're familiar, Terry Lovelace.
I've heard some about it. I don't know about his case in depth.
He had a camping experience when they went to Devil's Den. He and a buddy camped out at Devil's Den. And then there was this encounter. He later finds out that he had an implant. And the only thing that actually drew him to this is trying to figure out what was in his leg and a routine x-ray. Then when he found that, everything all unfolded. But just given the fact that he's in that same area that you guys are, you know, looking at, Northern Arkansas, Devil's Den State Park. Mm-hmm. So that's that's another, you know, another story that is local to this area that actually has an experiencer attached to it who has an implant, which makes it even more interesting.
Yeah, to be honest, I had an experience myself. I was 17. I was a senior in high school, and I was driving on a two-lane highway north of town to go pick up a couple of friends. We were going bowling that night. It was summertime. It was about 7 o'clock in the evening. It was still light outside, very light. And as I'm driving, I see what appears to be, at first I thought it was a helicopter coming towards me, just following the roadbed towards me. And that would have made sense from the location if you had a helicopter coming in to turn to go to one of the hospitals. They would have tracked that way. And so I didn't think much of it at first. But as it got closer, it was like, okay, that's not shaped like a helicopter. It's too big to be a helicopter. And then ultimately, this whatever it was hovers above the road, maybe about 50, 60 feet off the ground. And it's wide enough that it covers both sides of the road. So at least, 26 feet, maybe a little more. And it stops, it's maybe 100 yards in front of my car when I stopped. And I roll down my window, turn the radio off, and there's absolutely no noise. No sound of an engine or propulsion. But what I'm seeing, I'm thinking, is some sort of military craft, experimental craft or something, because it appears to be metallic. And it is round and basically sort of saucer shaped, but with a center panel that is flat between the two. Curved pieces. And actually that flat piece, there's actually two strips and they are rotating, one counterclockwise, one clockwise, and absolutely no sound. And at this point I'm thinking, oh my, there's no other cars out there. Oh my. Then a light comes out and shines down on the pavement. And I'm just sitting in the car. I'm literally thinking, do I start backing up? What do I do? But I'm still thinking this is just military. And at the time, there were ICBM missile silos about 15 miles away from where we're at. So, I'm just thinking this is military. And it hovers there maybe a minute and a half and then literally takes off at about a 45-degree angle and literally is out of sight in a fraction of a second. But again, still no noise, no chemtrail, no exhaust trail, nothing. And so could it be man-made? If so, we are still not seeing anything with that kind of capability.
No.
Again, you know, except for the way it took off, I would have said that's some sort of experimental craft because it, you know, it appeared to me to be a machine craft, you know. Mm-hmm. But I can't tell you what it was.
Is there any way if you would know if you had missing time?
As far as I know, I did not.
Okay. I mean, sometimes you remember, sometimes you don't. It's that thing of the fact that it was such a close encounter, and then there was a light involved with the little searchlight thing that the beam, the beam they do.
Yeah, as far as I know, there was not. I did not. I know I wasn't wearing a watch or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when I, you know, I then proceeded on and picked up my friends and you know, it wasn't like they're saying, you know, what took you so long, that
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
So,
yeah. There was no overt. No overt evidence.
Right. Yeah. So if there was, it wasn't very long.
With that sighting, though, when you figured out it left, did you talk to anybody about it?
I mean, I talked to a few friends. I mean, but it was just like, again, I was just like, you know, it's probably the Air Force doing something, you know, but again, I can't explain that kind of acceleration. You know, it went through my mind. Yeah, it could have been something extraterrestrial, but I don't know. Just the appearance of the craft and how the bands moved and everything, it just appeared to be a machine in the sense that we make machines.
Mm-hmm.
But even to this day, I'd say, yeah, it was some sort of experimental craft that we still don't know about, or they, you know, decided to not pursue or something, except for that acceleration.
I think we ought to check with Robert Bigelow, because he would know.
he probably would know.
Okay, he's probably behind it.
Well, this part predates him being into it. But,
it'd be his grandparents. When you investigate a lot of the hauntings, there are some significant and really fascinating areas in Missouri and Arkansas. And do you have a favorite where you went on a paranormal excursion and documented some evidence?
Well, I mean, that's kind of like asking me to pick between my kids. And in part because a big part of what we do is we work with historic sites. And so we have sites that we are at repeatedly, and I have sites that I've literally investigated thousands of hours. So
ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Say, I'm sorry, I didn't think about this one. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so, it's kind of hard to say a favorite because they each have a distinct personality, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so,
And
I've investigated some of the big places, you know, like Waverly Hills, et cetera. But I find usually the more active places, the more interesting places are ones that are, quote, not so much on the national radar. In part, I think some places just get hunted out and it goes flat.
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
And I think this is something that people don't realize is that, in my opinion anyway, as you're investigating, especially if you're doing this all night and it gets draining on you, and I think it tends to drain the energy that's there, whether it's intelligent or residual or whatever. And so when you have a location, say, the Villisca Etch Murder House or someplace that literally is booked out 7 days a week, every week of the year, I think you get tired entities. But it doesn't rebound. And I find that if we're in a location quite a bit and activity seems to be kind of settling off a little bit, we wait and don't go back for a few months, then it's more active again.
What did you say? What place is it that's booked 7 days a week all year? That sounds interesting.
Oh, well, like the Villisca Axe Murder House in Villisca, Iowa. That's one that particularly it's booked out every, I think, except for Christmas, it's booked every day of the year for teams to investigate.
Good grief. And I had no idea that was that intense an interest that people, so many people, that it's booked out every day. Wow.
Oh, yeah. There are locations that are that way. I think it is a double-edged sword because you end up, it's good for the location of getting revenue in, and you in the field, you get a lot of people, particularly not necessarily investigators, but enthusiasts and fans who will say, oh, you know, it's horrible that people charge to let people investigate, things like that. But most places they're not supported by, you know, state or federal funds, and you have private owners who are trying to keep up a historic building, which is very expensive.
Yeah.
Plus the cost of just the cost of insurance and electricity, et cetera. And then people saying, oh, you should just let everyone come in and out for free. No. Aside from wear and tear on the place. But the flip side is, if you get very successful and everyone wants to go there, then I think over time it can dampen the activity because it gets hunted out, basically.
I think it feeds the appetite is all of a sudden, you know, it needs to go on a diet.
Exactly. I mean, they get people out. They get people out just like we do.
Yeah. It's like, okay, that's real. I'm full now. I'm full. Now, I'm going to take a break for Christmas. I'll be back after the new year.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, no. Not more people. Yeah. Give me a vacation, you know.
Yeah.
But I really do think there is something to that. But yeah, there's a lot of really good locations. And it's funny, I've had this discussion with investigators from across the country. I know a lot of different people that I joke, I think per square mile, the Ozarks, particularly Southwest Missouri, tends to have more hauntings than a lot of places. And a lot of people will concur with that. And I think part of it is the history, because you have thousands of years of Native American history. You've got the Civil War, you've got Indian Wars, you've got in some places, lots of major mining fields. And then you get into the 20th century, and this was kind of the heart of a lot of the Depression-era gangster violence and all kinds of stuff.
I'm wondering if the geology has anything to do with it, because there's a lot of crystals.
That was what I was going to say, but I think part of it is that the Ozarks and Southwest Missouri mainly is on the Springfield Plateau. The Ozarks mountains technically aren't mountains. It's an uplifted uplands that have eroded. And so it's not so much that the mountains are tall, but the valleys and hollers are deep and have eroded over time from the limestone. And so we have karst limestone that has a very high crystal content. And I don't necessarily think it creates activity, but I think the geology tends to allow it to be amplified.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my thought. I also think it's a draw for the UFO stuff, because I do think that there is an energy source that supplies, whether we're aware of it or not. There's a reason that element is drawn to certain areas, and quartz crystal seems to be one of those things that's, whether it's an amplifier or whether it's some kind of a fuel element, I think that from what I have read and, you know, from other people who've talked about it, that seems to be a factor.
Well, I mean, for one, think of it this way. It is the most, quartz is the most stable conductor of electricity that we have. In fact, in our communication satellites, they don't use electrodes and transistors and computer relays. They use quartz. And the reason for that is they don't burn out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if a capacitor burns out on a satellite, that gets expensive to fit. So it's very stable conductor of energy. And so I do think there is something to that. But also, in a broader scope, Southern Missouri sits along the 37th parallel.
Yeah, yeah.
And the 37th parallel has a lot of UFO activity clear across the United States, right over to Roswell and Groom Lake, et cetera. So, you know, whether, you know, if the geology maybe affects the, you know, the runway patterns, I don't know. But they do tend to, experiences do tend to cluster around the 37th parallel. So.
Well, and that's fantastic. I mean, anything that we can do to draw some kind of correlation and see a pattern helps us, I think, determine, okay, so why is this important to know, and what might we be able to learn from that or access or utilize?
Exactly. Now, of course, there are a lot of military bases along that parallel, too, from Illinois, Missouri, and on west. And all of the stealth bombers are based in Missouri. And, you know, when we were, you know, we're at war and in the Middle East, they flew out of Missouri to the Middle East and back every day. So you have a lot of technology, and there are, you know, there are bases that have nuclear capacity. You have geology. You know, I think it's all rolled into one. It, you know, it makes sense that when you have all of those factors in an area, it may draw attention.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention the book, The 37th Parallel, because that talks about this and the unifying theme here of what's happening, UFOs along this area. The book is available. I remember hearing this when it first came out, Chuck Zukowski, who's a sheriff's deputy. And that it was like, oh, that's fantastic. Somebody's finally, you know, drawn a line and a map, and here they all are. Well, not all of them, but at least it gave us a good clue that there was a lot more going on in that area.
Yeah, at least a good cluster. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. So with the hauntings, and again, I ask you for a favorite. All right. So I guess what...
Yeah, I got distracted.
I know. Yeah. How convenient. Okay. Well, going right back. Of your top five that are the most distressing and uncomfortable and, you know, in terms of that you will go back, but boy, it's not a joyride. How about that? Does that help you narrow it down?
Well, here's the thing is I don't tend to get distressed. And in fact, I've had a lot of people ask me, does anything scare you? And generally, no. I've had one incident where I was starting to get a little concerned, but I wouldn't say I was scared. And that actually was at a Civil War battle site near Carthage, Missouri. And it was used throughout the war as an encampment, basically, by both sides at different times. And over time, we find that male investigators basically have no luck there. And so we will separate out. And so the women will investigate, and men will basically go to a whole different area, and the women will get results. And it really comes across as if I think whoever's there is wary of the men because they aren't sure, are you friend or foe? And they tend to be rather protective and paternalistic towards women. And so that's sort of interesting. But one night we had been to the far end of the park and we were starting to leave. It's probably 1 a.m. You have to walk out quite a ways to the parking area. And I happened to be the last person in line. And we're walking and all of a sudden I start to take a step and boom, I can't take a step. And I had the wet blanket effect, and I've had other investigators describe it as well. It's the only thing I can describe it as is as if the heaviest, wettest blanket fell over you, what that would feel like. But there's nothing there physically and you can still see everything. But my feet were rooted to the ground and I'm pushing forward. I call out, no noise comes out of my mouth. Everyone keeps walking. And so I'm pushing, this goes on long enough that they've probably walked a good 500 yards. So I'm beginning to say, okay, this isn't funny, you know. So I decide, you know, one big push, and I start, you know, every bit of strength I have push forward, and boom, the resistance is gone, and I have to catch myself from falling. I stand up, and I turn around, and behind me is standing a shadow man, and he looks as if he's in a Civil War uniform. You can see the line of his hat. He's got a long barrel rifle over his left shoulder, and he's facing towards me. And he turns to his left, takes three steps, and disappears. And so that time, yeah, I was getting concerned. I don't tend to get freaked out or scared. There is a location in Southeast Kansas, which actually is technically still that is actually in the Ozarks, that was an old bordello. It was built as a railroad hotel, which is also a euphemism for, you know, yes, it was a hotel for railroad worker, you know, guys coming down the train, but they would have women of the evening there and gambling and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some very atrocious murders that happened close by.
Which town is this in?
Galena, Kansas.
Oh, Galena. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And this is back in the heyday of the mining days.
Yeah.
And you had about 30,000 transient miners at any given time.
People would disappear in the strip pits.
Well, no, these weren't strip pits. These were pit mines. It wasn't strip mining. These were pit mines. And so you had holes that were, you know, hundreds of feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
But the bordello became associated with those murders because one of the bodies was found in a mine shaft that was just a few yards behind the building. And then one of the suspects was arrested at the intersection where it sits. And over time, locally, it got the legend that the murders happened there. It didn't. But, of course, we don't know what else happened there. But it could be very disturbing. It is one place that I have seen seasoned investigators leave and say, no, I'm not coming back. There is something there that is very angry. It's the only place I've ever investigated where I had a shadow person that would run at people.
Mm.
You know, shadow people tend to be very shy and run the other way, and you have to chase them, try to catch them.
Mm-hmm.
But there you have a shadow man that will dead on run, you know, buffalo run someone,
yeah.
and just go through them or whatever. And one night we were investigating and staying on the landing of the stairs, and there was an investigator to my left, and I was standing there, and then there was another lady who was standing facing directly at the stairs, the fly stairs going down. And the shadow man appeared at the bottom of the stairs and ran up, and she jumped to her left as he ran by and disappeared through the back wall. And we joked if she jumped another 6 inches, she and I would have had a Scooby-Doo moment. and it's funny because I know her now, and I hadn't seen her for years. Ran into her not too long ago, and I was like, I know you. And she goes, yeah, we had the Scooby-Doo moment almost, remember? And I was like, oh, yeah. But you would have things there that felt very oppressive, and people would end up with the sensation of being drunk and so forth. And I've seen seasoned investigators just walk out and say, nope, I'm not going back in there.
Well, you have to trust your gut on something like that, because
yes.
That's a real feeling when you have that no,
mm-hmm.
This isn't a good place for me.
Exactly.
You can turn sour if you don't honor that.
That's true. Now, I will say, interesting thing that happened to me. This is sort of in the Ozarks borderlands, though, because it was in Alton, Illinois. Josh and I were investigating Mineral Springs in Alton, and which has become pretty popular for investigations. But we were in the basement area and starting to go upstairs, and our This was just during our preliminary tour of the building with the owner, and the owner's ahead of us, and there's one more person ahead of me than me, and Josh is behind me, and we're walking up, start up the stairs, and I look up and I see a mist, but it's in the fully formed in the shape of a fist and a forearm, and coming straight at me. And I had the sensation of being punched in the face to the point my head went back and I went down on one knee, and I actually had the bridge of my nose was sore afterwards. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they were aiming for me or someone else in the group. I don't know, but it's an area of the building that tends to have more aggressive activity in. So, you know, I mean, I wasn't scared, but it was like, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think in some ways that needed to happen, because you say you are not normally influenced and not intimidated, not frightened. It, you know, takes a whole lot, like a bat, mm-hmm. to get through to you. And that was basically the bat in the face.
Well, I'm not even sure it was meant for me. But now I experience a lot of activity. I'm an empath and clairsentient, but, mm-hmm. But for those reasons, and I think because of those reasons too, I tend not, you know, I don't panic. I don't have that, oh my gosh, reaction.
Right.
It's a part, you know, paranormal activity is just another aspect of life. And it happens around us. It happens around us often when we aren't aware of it. And people who are frightened by it, that freaks them out.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to tell people, you know, you may have had breakfast with someone this morning that you just didn't see. And if you accept that, it becomes much less scary, much less, quote, paranormal, and just part of normal life.
I like the way you address that, in that I don't know that that was intended for me. What you're doing is remaining objective. You're not judging and jumping to conclusions that it was an attack. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
So. No, I mean, there was nothing to indicate necessarily that something had a beef with me personally. And so, I mean, maybe they were aiming for the owner. Maybe it was the person in front of me. Maybe it was Josh behind me. I don't know. Or maybe they were just showing off.
Yes, yes. What I got was, get a load of this. Get a load, see what I can do. Yes. It was more like
exactly.
That. And you are a hard person to impress. So there it is. Here's the opportunity. Look what I got here. You know, that was my sense. It was a show off.
It very well could have been, yeah. It very well could have been. And yeah, it was like, oh, and my reaction was, okay, that makes it, okay, it's going to be more interesting now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know.
You couldn't do this if you were afraid of your own shadow. So when you're going in, you're looking, you're being incredibly objective and open and saying, okay, what am I going to experience here? And so something like that, you're saying, like you said, well, this is interesting.
Well, you know, it's okay. It's just like, you know, the reality shows. And don't get me wrong. I know those guys. I know most of those guys.
Yeah.
I've been on most of those shows. And people, you know, watching, even a lot of fans, they don't get that, particularly some of the shows more than others even, it's entertainment value. And it's done done in a particular way. Yeah. To be viewed on TV. You can't really do that realistically and investigate, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They don't always perform when you show up just because you have a camera. Sometimes the cameras go dark and then you're supposed to perform and good luck.
Well, not only that, but if you act like you're freaked out and oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, you know, which some of the shows are, they rely on that trope a lot.
Yeah.
You know, one, you're going to contaminate any evidence that you get. And two, it's just not realistic. I don't buy it.
Well, then the focus becomes on the person who is there as the investigator. It takes the focus away from the site, from the investigation, from any of that evidence to whoever's on the big screen making the big eyes and going, help me, I've been ghosted. You know, that's just...
Exactly. I mean, and that's, and let's face it, that is a big part of what, you know, the production companies, the networks, they need to make money. They need the viewers, and viewers react to that. Some by laughing, some by, oh my gosh, because it's fed into that cycle. It's gotten to a point that the idea of let's present what it's really like investigating is not even on the table for TV shows.
Right. Yeah, there's a formula and it works and it pays the bills. It makes money. Right. Yeah, it gets an audience.
Because they're afraid, boy, if we show how it really works, people will get bored and they won't tune in.
It takes 7 hours to get one EVP.
Well, and, you know, they often will portray it, oh, this all happened in one night.
Yeah.
They were really there for 2 weeks, you
right.
know.
I mean, and the good thing, though, is if someone does spend 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 6 months at a site, then you can get evidence and play it back in an hour. But boy, that doesn't happen in 30 minutes or 45 minutes. Some people show up and say, okay, we did the investigation. There's nothing here. You didn't bother.
Well, no. And another thing that they don't advertise is that they have storylines, and they have storylines per season typically. So what happens is they're looking for particular hauntings, particular stories, particular sites that fit into the storyline for that season. Then they call people like me saying, do you have something that fits this? And if you understand what's going on, it's perfectly fine. And like I said, I like those guys. You know, some of those guys, I've worked with a number of times and I like them a lot. But you can't look at those shows as, quote, investigation.
Again, Lisa Martin hosts Dark Ozarks with Josh Heston.
Personally, I hope, given the whole archive that you guys have built up, that you do find a producer, you find a production company that's going to get this to get you some more work, okay? Let's put it that way.
Well, that would be good. And the thing of it is then hopefully in a manner that we have enough creative control that it is a show that we want, you know, and
yeah.
not fall victim to the, oh, we have to do these tropes.
Yeah.
That would be fantastic. In the meantime, we're having a blast. So.
Well, and the show, you guys do a podcast. You also have the website, Facebook, the Dark Ozarks site on Facebook, mm-hmm. and then the webpage, Dark Ozarks. And this is, you know, between the two of you, this is a really good archive of all sorts of interesting and unique experiences with the paranormal.
Well, thank you. We put a lot into it, and there's also a YouTube channel as well. So, and we cover, and that's the thing, we cover a lot of things. We cover not only the paranormal and cryptids, UFOs, et cetera, but we cover dark history. We cover folklore, legends, and basically how all of these things fit together, and also how they fit together in the larger, broader scope of lore across the nation and sometimes across the world, which you don't see that happen a lot. And so, you know, we're proud of that we try to tie these things together and get people thinking about things in broader terms too.
Well, and that's the thing. Paranormal isn't just relegated to one part of the world. It's global. This happens. Mm-hmm. We just don't have the language to continue to, you know, compare notes in history. We're getting more of that. But that's the fun thing about this is it will relate to somebody else who says, oh, my gosh, this happened here. And they may be in South America, Australia, New Zealand. It's all mm-hmm. over the world. And so sharing these stories gives other people permission to start digging into their own archives and saying, hey, we've got the same stories here. Let's share.
Exactly. You know, but I think it builds a understanding of how all of these things fit together. And over time, particularly we have almost a displacement in our society with how we view our own stories. And it really came about from the Industrial Revolution. And then post-World War II with pop culture and that basically what's happened is that the media, even some of these TV shows we talked about, they basically have co-opted our shared received lore. They regurgitate it back in movies or TV shows, in usually in a pretty simplified manner. And over time, over the last few decades, people have started accepting that that is it, not realizing that is basically just the boiled down version of what we've received from, you know, hundreds of years or thousands of years in some cases of experience and lore. And it's interesting that when we do live events and we talk about some of the things, you can see, you know, light bulbs come on with people going, oh, wow, this connects to this, this connects to that. And so we're proud of doing that.
Okay, we did this whole conversation here and didn't get into the spook light. You have a book.
Yes, we are finishing it up, and it will be out. We had a delay in publication. It'll be out in the spring, but it covers the Hornet spook light and other ghost lights through the Ozarks. But the Hornet spook light, some people will refer to it as the Joplin spook light or the Tri-State spook light, is probably the most infamous ghost light in the country, with the Marfa lights coming in second in Texas. Mm-hmm. But it's a little different because with Marfa, it's interesting because you see lights in the same place every night, and to the point that they have telescopes set up, you know, that you can feed quarters into so you can view it better.
Yeah.
And so whatever is happening there is happening in one specific spot. The spook light here is much different because it ranges over, you know, about 10 square miles. And it has a history that goes back hundreds of years, predates settlement. And most of the explanations that are thrown out don't make sense. And it's very interesting to me because it started out because it straddles basically the area straddles the Missouri-Oklahoma border, but it started out in Missouri and was seen around Hornet, Missouri for decades. And then it kind of migrated and was on the other side of the state line around a particular road for another 20, 30 years. And that is where you had the Army Corps of Engineers come in, you had universities come in, et cetera, do studies, and basically they came up with the standard, it's swamp gas or it's headlights.
Hundreds of years, headlights.
Yeah. And swamp gas, well, you know, there's not a whole lot of decaying organic matter sitting around there. There's no marsh or swampy area there, I tell you.
Well, that's what's so funny about it, though. That's like a one-size-fits-all. We have no clue, but swamp gas sounds good. Done.
Exactly. And then you have the added factor, and then it moved further south and to what became known as Spook Light Road and was seen for a very long time there. And now it's kind of migrated again further east. So it's just really interesting because you have something that is seen over a large area. So you can't just put up a telescope and look at it and say, oh, that's where it is.
Well, some of the stories, I went to college in that area, and some of the stories were that light would even come up to the vehicle. It would come up close to people. So that's some of the lore that goes with that it is mobile.
I know people who, you know, have had it go through the cabin of their car. I know people who've had it hit the top of their car and the paint is scorched. I know people who live down there and they've had it, you know, come up in their yards, in their barns, across their property. Sometimes it's seen up in the trees. Sometimes it's down low. And sometimes it splits in two. One of the times that I saw it long time ago in college, we were out there. There were three of us, and we were in two vehicles, and one vehicle parked facing east, one facing west, you know, opposite sides of the road, but we were about 20, 25 feet between the vehicles. And we'd been watching, had not seen it come up, and boom, it appeared right between the vehicles. Hmm. Although it had, no one had seen it approaching, and we'd been watching all directions. Other times you see it approach. I mean, there's all kinds of lore, native lore that connects it to a Indian chief that was beheaded on a cliff not too far away from where people think of it being, to settler stories of it being a farmer looking for lost children, and it's the lantern, and even, supposedly a miner, although there was no mining right there, and all of this. And, you know, you have thousands of people who have seen it and experienced it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's so cool about it.
Mm-hmm. And ironically, and what a lot of people don't realize now is there was a major marketing program made basically through like chambers of commerce and so forth from the 1930s to the 1950s that was kind of named the Land of Million Smiles campaign of portraying the Ozarks as, you know, on vacation here, and it was based in Joplin, Missouri here, and there were a lot of advertising that centered around the spook light, basically enticing people to come look at it, come look for it, and if while you're, you know, while you're doing that, stop at this restaurant and take food out there and do this and that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you have this sort of this culture that built up around it, that it was a natural part of growing up. You went out there with your parents as kids. You went out there as teenagers, you know, to face your fears.
Well, there was a house that was there at one point marking it, and you'd get directions from the person at that house. It was
Well, actually a little building. It was a little museum, Spookies.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And And so, you know, it's the only one that I know of that has that kind of culture that built up around it, you know. You have a lot of ghost-like stories that, you know, you have, you know, the lore of why is there a light there, but you don't have that inclusive experience for an entire region, you know. And I find it, one reason we decided to write the book is that, one, it's the story we get asked about the most. And then two, what we have found over time is that we are losing a lot of our lore.
Yeah.
And people are forgetting. And so at events, we often, you know, if something comes up that brings up the subject of the spook light, we'll do the, you know, how many people have seen the spook light? Raise your hands, you know, and how many have heard of it, you know? And over time, you know, just, you know, 15 years that I've been doing public events, I've noticed fewer hands are going up, and they tend to be older. And now we're getting from young people, either they've never heard of it, or they don't think it you know, exists in any way.
Right.
But it's still there, and it, you know, and can be experienced. Part of the problem there was the road that most people would park on to look for it got paved. And when they paved it, they didn't put in shoulders. So there's no place to park. And so the sheriff will run people off if you park on that road.
How convenient. Yeah.
Yeah. And granted, the way the road is, you don't want to be parked out there because you're going to end up getting rear-ended or something.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the thing is, since it's not something that is just seen in one specific spot, you can park other places that you can park and see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's still something that can be experienced, but we are losing that collective experience that for, you know, really almost 100 years, it was something that everybody in, you know, 50 miles shared. You know, everyone had been out to the spook light at some point. And what was your experience? What was that? When we lose that kind of shared frame of references with each other, we lose something more too.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad because this has been, well, you know, obviously I'm older, so I remember it. And I went, was in school in that area, and people who were not from that area asked me about it. So there was this enigma about the spook light. The fact that it's interactive makes it even more fascinating, and that you can go and you may or may not have an experience, but you may know somebody else who does. So it's still, you know, it's a fascinating piece of our reality, I think.
I do too. And again, it is a true mystery because we really don't know what it is. And, you know, swamp gas, no. headlights, you know, there is a particular temperature inversion that, I mean, now, of course, you're going to have, it's only going to occur when you have a layer of hot air and cold air. And as the night happens, they flip. And what will happen is if you're standing on a particular spot on the road, you can, through the temperature inversion, see the reflection of headlights from I-44, which before that was Route 66. But if that happens, you see double rows of lights because you're seeing headlights. And so it's like you're seeing headlights, multiple cars going across a movie screen. But that's not what people experience.
No.
By and large.
No, not at all. It's more of an interactive. It comes toward you. It's closer to you, around you. It makes itself, in a way, makes itself known.
Yes. And to be honest, the best reference description I can give is it's like a ball of plasma, or almost, you know, sometimes almost like a lava lamp, you know, because it's something that has substance to it and can change shape, can split into, sometimes it's different colors, and it moves over a large area. And that's not something that is a reflection of light or methane from, you know, a pond or something, which still doesn't, you know, make sense. But and, you know, I think maybe it does have something to do with geology as well. There are some earth lights that happen near earthquake zones that they think are a product of tension being released in the fault line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't have that here, but we have we do have the bedrock limestone and all of the crystals. So maybe it has something to do with that. I don't know. Or it could be something completely different that we just have no concept of at this point.
Not yet. And we're looking forward to that.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of it existing. It's like, okay, come on. You'll get here eventually. Don't hurry. Don't rush. It's still going to be here whether you figure it out or not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Give the grandkids something to look forward to.
Exactly. I think that is one of the real beauty of the spook light is it exists whether people want it to or not. And it is a true mystery that confounds people, a lot of people these days, because they want to put everything in a Chinese box and everything has to fit in a nice, neat little box. And they want to think that we are at a point that we can explain everything, but there are still some mysteries out there. And I think the world is better off with having them.
Okay, so for more mysteries and more unsolved enigmas that are haunting us, your show, you guys do the podcast, and people can check you out there to find out more of these. I mean, it's the tip of the iceberg. 4 years you've been doing this, so the next podcast is when?
We do live streams on YouTube and Facebook every Wednesday night, starting at 7:30 Central Time. The podcasts drop various times, but you can find the podcast, Dark Ozarks, on all of the major podcast apps, from Spotify, Apple, et cetera, et cetera. And there's over 100 episodes of the podcast, and there's over 200 of the live streams. So there's a lot out there that you can delve into and see what you're interested in. And we're always interested in hearing what people want to hear about too. So don't feel bad about dropping us a message saying, hey, what about this or that? But you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and on your favorite podcast app.
I love it because it's global. You know, you're everywhere at once.
Sometimes it amazes me where, you know, some of the listeners are at, that, you know, it's like, oh, wow, really? You know?
I have one at the North Pole.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, that is so cool. Maybe it's Santa.
Maybe Santa, or maybe someone at a science station or something.
Yes, yes. So anyway, so there we go. Thank you. Awesome. I appreciate your time. I love what you're doing. I think you've really found a wonderful niche, and I think you're going to have some positive results with that TV production, and
just
crossing fingers.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this and love the talk, and look forward to doing it again.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. Now you're on the list.
Good deal.
Links are in the description for the show. And again, a special shout out. It's really cool to see listeners in the locations. The North Pole was a really pleasant surprise. So thank you for listening, wherever you are. Stay curious.